It's a great pleasure to welcome you all to the launch of our book, Loughborough Festival Opera, The First 30 Years. For those of you that don't know, my name is Polly Graham, Artistic Director of Loughborough Festival Opera. There are so many people to thank and to recognise as being essential agents in the creation and evolution of this festival. If you're here, you're probably one of them. Theatre is a social art form, and it's taken a community to build this project, and in turn, this project has evolved a wonderful community. However, there are a few individuals that I would like to name. Alan Privett, who for many years directed our Wagner work at Loughborough, among many other things, and Jenny Miller, who sadly cannot be here today. Both Alan and Jenny's creativity and input to the festival you can read about at length in the wonderful book by Richard Bratby. I'd also like to thank Lucy and Mark Lefanu, who are absolutely the reason that we have a book. It was their idea, their generosity and initiative and energy spearheaded and began that project. And it's delightful to be celebrating its fruition with you all today. A little bit of housekeeping, please turn off your mobile phones as this event is being recorded. The format of today is music, discussion, and readings. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce my esteemed colleagues who have so generously agreed to participate in our discussion. Anthony Negus, who is our musical director, Mark LeBrock, who is a tenor, and Roderick Williams, baritone. So thank you to all of them, and to Sophie Redfern, who is chairing the discussion, and to Richard Bratby, who is going to be speaking, and who is, of course, the author of Loughborough Festival Opera, The First 30 Years.
I love you. That was Mark LeBrock and Anthony Negus, and that was Franz Lehár's You Are My Heart's Delight from his 1929 opera, The Land of Smiles. The line, dreams of mine may perchance come true, seems particularly apt, given the extraordinary story of Loughborough Festival Opera, and it is that story that we're here to celebrate today, and the documenting that story by Richard Bratby. You're a writer, critic, author of the new book. You review for The Spectator, Gramophone, Birmingham Post. I know you're also much in demand as a programme note annotator and essayist. And this is not your first rodeo in terms of books, of institutions, perhaps idiosyncratic institutions, we might acknowledge. You also wrote Forward 100 Years of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, and very recently, sort of concurrently with your one on Loughborough, of Refiner's Fire, the Academy of Ancient Music and the Historical Performance Revolution. So that's your kind of background. You're bringing all of that weight to this. And I was wondering, actually, before we get into tales of the book and kind of those stories that come out of it, perhaps we could start with the more practical side. How did you become involved, and what was your relationship to Loughborough before you started?
Well, I think, like a lot of us, I sort of stumbled on Loughborough almost by accident. I said it's like sort of opening a door to this magical world, almost like Narnia, you know. I was working for the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra at the time in Birmingham, and working closely with musicians there, and many of the musicians, regular performers in the Loughborough orchestra. And people talk, you know, you talk at tea breaks, and I remember more and more players talking about this extraordinary thing that's going on down in the Cotswolds, and they've been spending their summers doing Wagner. And the one particular player, Ian Foster, the tuba player, who also works a great deal with the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford, just got me in a corridor and said, have you heard what they're doing in Loughborough? It's incredible. And I'd kind of assumed it was a fairly, as one does, rather lazily assumed it was a fairly, you know, it was some people with a piano bashing out the Barbara Sevier in a tent every summer. And he's saying, no, it's incredible, Ring Cycles, you know, it's, you know, I love Wagner. He said, oh, you need to be there. And he got me a comp to the dress rehearsal, I think it was, of the Valkyrie in the 2013 cycle. That's my first contact. It's immediately you realise you've entered this a world that's like nothing, and certainly nothing I'd imagined. And I love Wagner. I'm lifelong Wagnerite. My parents named me after Wagner. So something of the idea to me that someone might, it's true, I'm narrowly escaped being named Siegfried. But the idea that, an individual might, takes upon themselves, a couple, this remarkable couple, takes upon themselves to build an opera house and fulfil this dream of staging Wagner in their back garden. To me, that seems unbelievably wonderful. At the same time, totally understandable. Who wouldn't, given the choice? And these people actually had. And I, initially, attending rehearsals, then attending performances, latterly as a critic, first for the Birmingham Post. Latterly, I've been a critic for The Spectator, and my great colleague on The Spectator, mentor, Michael Tanner, a phenomenal Wagner scholar and philosopher, actually took me aside once and said, what they're doing at Loughborough is actually closer, I think, to the spirit, the true spirit of what Bayreuth should be and was intended to be than what's actually happening at Bayreuth. Take them very, very seriously, he said to me. And since that time, I've not missed a season, of course. And you enter this world, you feel, I think, like we all feel, that you're entering a group of friends, you're entering a community of some very remarkable, very interesting, but very welcoming people. And this is as it should be. This is art, this is opera as it should be. This is a community of people deeply committed to the music and to doing it in the best possible, and the drama, to doing it in the best possible, most accessible way.
Absolutely. So from this kind of passion for it, how did the kind of book side then come in, and how did you set about researching and writing it?
I was deeply flattered to be asked to do it, of course, very flattered. When Martin and Lizzie ask you to do a favour, you don't say no, do you? When Loughborough comes asking, it's deeply flattering. And I've acquired a bit of a reputation as a sort of institutional biographer now. I say this is the third organisation I've written I see it more as a biography than a history, really. It's because you know, you're either writing a long list of performances and reviews, or you're talking to the people who make these organisations, and that is what it's about. It's every one of these organisations, in their own way, is a community of remarkable people who've come together sharing ambitions, sharing problems, finding solutions, working together, and coming up generally along the line with absolutely incredible stories. I mean, at the heart of it all, as we all know, it's a remarkable couple, Martin and Lizzie, who, as we all know, have a lot of stories to tell. wonderful stories to tell. That's a great starting point.
That is a great starting point. So I think that's where we can lift off, really, and hear a little bit more about Martin and perhaps one of those stories, and really how the passion for music comes from that would lead to an opera house in a garden. So Mark LeBrock is on double duty this morning, and I'm going to hand over for the first of our excerpts.
The story starts in a Gloucestershire village with a young boy clambering from his bedroom window onto the hillside behind his parents' house, determined to explore. Nearly six decades later, in February 2013, Martin Graham set out from the field not far away, where he'd built a family home and an opera house, and retraced the paths he'd taken as a boy. Martin came to the village of Longborough in 1949 at the age of six, when his father, a telecoms engineer, took a job at the RAF base at Little Rissington. The family moved into Pear Tree Cottage. Martin attended the village primary school and at the evening and weekends made his own adventures in a village on a hillside outside Moreton-in-Marsh. Longborough has never been anyone's idea of a metropolis, but it was the centre of a thriving rural economy. And to a small boy, in the years after the Second World War, it felt boundless. Growing up in the 1950s in a Cotswold village was not dissimilar to Laurie Lee's childhood, he remembers. A world almost without the internal combustion engine. Few telephones, just the kiosk, a parson, yeoman farmers, and so on. Innocently occupying that decade in the shadow of the war, we were unaware that it was the last post-war, pre-war period. The parish was our world. We seldom strayed outside its invisible barriers. It was our custodian and our carer. We were born and died within its sphere, in each case at home. Little more seemed necessary. There were nocturnal escapades with the chemist's son. He had access to the dispensary, where he knocked up gunpowder in the small hours, recalls Martin. They would plan their adventures at full moon using a secret phone hidden in a dry stone wall. There were father and son rides into the surrounding countryside, Martin on his bicycle, his father riding the tricycle upon which he commuted the 8 miles to work each morning. And in the living room of the family home was a radio, bringing a potent and limitless force to that Gloucestershire hillside. Music. The Light programme supplied most of it. Grand Hotel, Max Jaffa's trio, Housewives' Choice. Early hits which were stored away for calling up when times were bad would be Cattelby's Bells Across the Meadows, Oh Worship the King, or Handel's Largo. These and many others oscillated round my 10-year-old brain for future reference and joy. Much later, when I had a girlfriend, I tape-recorded Cattelby's Sanctuary of the Heart, thinking this would promote excitement in my Austin 7. The ruse failed. We parted, me and the girlfriend, but Sanctuary remained. The breakthrough was Jack Wilshire, a gangling ex-railwayman from East London, completely self-taught in the arts, who, for the sake of today's reading, and indeed today's reader, will have a slightly nomadic northern accent. So each day, the village of Longborough witnessed the sight of Wilshire in plus fours taking his daily constitutional, followed by a cadaverous greyhound and a small boy, Martin. It didn't seem especially peculiar. A typical morning would begin with a song. That was the hurdy-gurdy song, Martin, he would announce. This was received in silence. Schubert was a wonderful man, you know. Almost as great as Mozart. More silence from me. More interestingly, the dog yelped and chased an old lady's cat. Mozart was the greatest composer who ever lived.
Mr. Wilshire, your dog's got me cut up the apple tree. What you gonna do about it?
Screeched an old crone. Ignoring this, Jack continued. Mind you, some say Wagner was a great composer, but let me tell you, he was a bloody poltroon. He was almost as bad as the man who invented the internal combustion engine. Jack hated cars as well as Wagner.
What about me cat, Mr. Wilshire?
Jack turned to the cottage, in the doorway of which stood the old crone, arms akimbo, unmoved by his musical analysis. Didn't you know Mozart liked cats? Followed by, he'll be all right. Then, turning to me earnestly, remember, Mozart's the greatest and Wagner's horrible. Why, he takes nearly half an hour with his overtures. I tried to appear interested. Until that morning, I'd never heard of either composer. One of these days, Martin, you'll come to me and say you've heard Figaro and you can't stop listening to it. It'll be like a love affair, he said, rolling his eyes languorously. And then you'll tell me you've tried Wagner and you feel like killing yourself. Jack Wilshire's friendship and gentle idiosyncratic tuition made a lifelong impression. It wasn't just a question of recognising Schubert's Winterreiser when you heard it. It was an understanding that a love of music could be self-taught and a pleasure for life. That culture, even the highest of high culture, belonged in Loughborough as much as it belonged in London. One piece of Jack's advice, however, went unheeded. Wagner will be the death of you!
Im Dorfe steht ein Leiermann und mit starren Fingern dreht er, was er kann. Barfuß auf dem Eise wankt er hin und her. Und sein kleiner Teller bleibt ihm immer leer. Und sein kleiner Teller bleibt ihm immer leer. Keiner mag ihn hören, keiner sieht ihn an. Und die Hunde knurren um den alten Mann. Und er lässt es gehen, alles wie es will. Dreht und seine Leier steht ihm nimmer still. Dreht und seine Leier steht ihm nimmer still. Soll ich mit dir gehen? willst zu meinen Liedern deine Leier
was Roderick Williams and Anthony Negus there with the very hurdy-gurdy song that Jack Wilshere had so impressed on the young Martin. That hurdy song was actually Der Leiermann from Schubert's Winterreise song cycle. So, at this point, we have a passionate music lover in Martin, but how do we get from that to staging opera in the garden, and perhaps more significantly, too, from entertaining the idea of building an actual opera house in that garden, too? Polly, I wondered if you could sort of talk us through a little bit of the early sort of origins and how we sort of got to that point.
All I can really say is, from the perspective of a child, I was brainwashed from a very early age. In this kind of hotbed of radicalism. And, you know, theatre and music were just a very normal thing for us as children. And I can remember, you know, once you get the bug, it's very, very difficult to shake. So I would just think, oh my God, we had the summer festival. I feel so sad, but Christmas will come and then it will be okay, because when Christmas is over, the music festival will happen again. And that's what my internal kind of narrative was. Of course, basically things started in the house we grew up in first, which was Banks Fee, where there was a stable block and a courtyard. So it was kind of Dad invited Peter Knapp's travelling opera to come there and present The Marriage of Figaro, The Barber of Seville, etc., etc., with a very small, you know, perhaps 11-piece orchestra. And then when we moved, he really started kind of changing his plans and really taking on this, like, I am going to do this. And the more people said, you're insane, he was like, I'm really going to do this. So that's kind of it.
So we've got ambition and we've got drive and determination, certainly. Shall we hear a little bit more about this then and how it sort of took shape, I think, if we have another excerpt from Mark on how building the theatre, I think, then.
Martin Graham tells many stories about the opera house that he built at New Banks Fee, the home that he created for his growing family in a field just north of the original Banks Fee house. Many stories have been told about it, too. Some involve sheep, a few involve cattle, most of them involve chickens. And all of them make it sound almost absurdly easy. Here in the North Cotswolds, we have staged opera in our garden each summer since 1991, and in our opera house since 1996, he wrote in 1999, with the very substantial benefit of hindsight. It is said that at tea parties as a boy, George Christie of Glyndebourne asked his hosts for directions to their opera house. The presence of a 10,000 square foot colonnaded Palladian building 100 metres from our drawing room is as normal to us as a coal bunker. It seemed perfectly simple initially. Why not create tiered seating in the garden by taking advantage of the natural rake of the bank? Construct a stage at the bottom with makeshift cover, hire a travelling troupe of players, announce the event, sell the tickets, and bingo! Well, not quite. For whilst most seasons produced a full house in terms of audience capacity, there the housey-housey link ended. We always made a loss. Inspired nevertheless, and in the manner of determined gamblers, we decided the answer was a proper opera house. We had a modern but derelict farm building at the edge of the garden. An architect friend remarked that its proportions lent themselves to the Palladian style. Could the draftsman have been a remote descendant from the Veneta? So why not build a facade with concrete blocks and paving slabs and render and paint the lot pink and white in the style of Trompe l'œil? Here in the Cotswolds, to think is to act. So up the thing duly went. Just like that. For a successful developer like Martin Graham, managing a large building project felt as simple and instinctive as making a cup of tea. Even while mulling over options for the bank's fee stable block, Martin had been considering building an entirely new opera house as early as the spring of 1993. A Morton in Marsh architects firm drew up several designs for a theatre, one with a Palladian facade, one distantly but distinctly resembling, a taste of things to come, a miniature version of Richard Wagner's Festspielhaus at Bayreuth. Both, at this point, faced towards Bank's Fee. The site was occupied by a pair of old barns, used to house chickens and, for a while, a friend's cows. A planning application was submitted to Cotswold District Council in the summer of 1993, seeking permission to replace it with a new opera house.
So we have a theatre, or a theatre in progress, and it's going to be a sort of constant period, actually, of evolution of the theatre and a sort of ongoing project while other things are happening. And I think we've heard so much about Wagner, really, we should start talking about The Ring and the relationship of The Ring to Loughborough. And I wondered, Anthony, actually, if you, maybe sort of, and Polly could lead on this. But so we started with the mini ring, the dove, and then that grew. So could you sort of talk us through a little bit about the relationship between The Ring and Loughborough and how that developed?
Greetings, everybody. Yes, the small ring arranged by Jonathan Dove for an orchestra of 18 players was already in progress when Alan Privett rang me up and told me that they'd lost their conductor, Alistair Dawes, who had conducted the Rheingold in 1998 and Valkyrie in 1999. Would I like to come and conduct Siegfried in 2000? And the revival of Valkyrie. So I was thrilled, actually, to be asked to do that, having been a member of the music staff. Well, I was still, for the next 11 years, still on the music staff, Welsh National Opera, where I did a lot of conducting, but very often as assistant to other great interpreters who came there. So it was my chance to be independent and do my own thing. So I was really, really grateful for the offer, and I turned up. And I'd just like to mention, there's a picture in the book of me carrying a big carrier bag, which had the Jonathan Dove score of Siegfried. And it was on my birthday, which is June the 8th, the same as Cordelia's. It was her 13th birthday, and it was my 54th. And so we celebrated outside the house. It was before Martin built the new extension. It was a beautiful day. I'd just conducted the first piano stage rehearsal of Valkyrie Love Scene, so I was full of warmth. And it was the start for me of the most wonderful personal contact with the family. And I was saying to them this morning, every time I come into that house, I feel it's like coming home. It's the most wonderful feeling. And just doing opera in the family atmosphere, I think I've been very fortunate, because I worked at Bayreuth for two seasons with Wolfgang Wagner before all the scandals took place in the mid-70s, where it was wonderful atmosphere. Everybody was colleague and so on. And it had a family atmosphere. Welsh National Opera had a family atmosphere, but nothing like Loughborough's family atmosphere. That was absolutely unique. And so anyway, we built the ring, and we did the full cycles of this small ring, lasting about 9 hours, you know, separate evenings. In 2002, Brian Bannatyne Scott was Vautrin. It was, of course, Alan Privett's production. He'd broken his leg in 1998 when he was on the set for the Rheingold, one of the dramas of Loughborough, you know, from the very beginning. But anyway, he'd recovered by the time I turned up. And then we had a year off, and then in 2004, we had to replace our Vautrin, And so who should we replace him with but Sir Donald McIntyre, which really raised the game. And so we did several cycles in 2004. That I think by that time, I had made the orchestra, with the help of Philip Head, our orchestra manager, who is here today, incidentally, and also our leader, Catherine Gittings, who is here today, and our wonderful principal flautist, Diane Clark, who is here today. we did that. I think probably that's as far as I should take it now, isn't it?
So we've got this, we're moving now. Shall we move on to...
Up to you.
Is there any particular memories, you say? I was wondering whether a particular memory of the ring, actually, sort of any particular anecdote that really stood out. Maybe for you, actually, as a child. Kind of,
well, you know. I mean, I think all of us, as a, you know, for us children, it was our first time seeing this work, seeing and hearing this work. And, I've, you know, the ending of Götterdämmerung is just so overwhelming anyway. And to see that as a teenager was very powerful and impactful, I would say. Lots of memories of Donald McIntyre wandering around in his pants. My best friend Frankie, whose parents are here today, was basically employed to be the Donald minder because, you know, blink and you'd miss him, and he constantly had to be kind of shepherded into position to then go onto stage at the right time. So, yeah.
Family atmosphere. I mean, we're really getting a sense of that today. Now, I think this is a good time to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, actually, as we move from the artistic highs to the bureaucratic lows, or even woes, for our third excerpt. This is an episode that I think would even perhaps best be summed up as the saga of the planning permission.
Wagner's Das Rheingold, explained Martin, in one of many interviews that he would give to the local and national press over the next few months, involves giants trying to destroy Valhalla. Some may say not unlike the council. Seasoned Wagnerians might disagree with that precise interpretation, but Martin's point was clear enough. All we want to do is share what we have with others, he added. My family has always been interested in the opera, and this seems a worthwhile thing to do. Some people spend their money on Ferraris. I choose to spend it on opera. For now, though, in the autumn of 1997, Cotswold District Council's enforcers were emphatic. The new theatre contravened planning regulations. The Grahams and their lawyers disagreed. Like Fazold and Fafner, Cotswold District Council would discover in due course that they had picked a battle of wills with the wrong family. A local journalist had picked up the information from the agenda for the next planning meeting. He faxed it through, and sure enough, there it was, remembers Martin. Apparently, the council's enforcement officer had visited our property unannounced while we were away, taken notes and made sketches, concluded that a serious breach of planning regulations had occurred, and translated this into a brief report recommending demolition. Until my intervention, CDC's employment policies favoured ex-policemen for the post of enforcement officers on account of their being experienced in interviewing, i.e. hectoring innocent council taxpayers like me. So it came as no surprise to see a report offering planning advice from an officer with no planning training. Just 30 years of collar feeling, a habit that's hard to kick. The committee accepted the report completely. The demolition order was confirmed. After all, anything arty must be stopped, and be sure to be quick about it. One member wistfully announced that she hoped demolition could proceed forthwith so as to prevent another performance in 1998. The fight back proceeded on several fronts, as neighbours, opera-goers and well-wishers wrote to the local press in support. They'd received that Christmas a greeting card from Longborough showing the new theatre, radiant amid green meadows, with the slogan, Save the Opera, and the caption, The Opera House, Longborough, Gloucestershire. Demolition sought by Cotswold District Council, 1998. Martin also appended a quote from Samuel Beckett's Westward Ho, try again, fail again, fail better. Debate was far from one-sided. A group of hostile locals coordinated a counter-assault against what one termed, the phrase kept recurring, a pink-painted monstrosity totally out of keeping with the Cotswolds. We won't be starting up our lawnmowers to drown out his singers, but we are pretty upset about it. He's a very naughty boy, one villager told Classic FM magazine. Pull down this pink eyesore, ran another headline. Both the design and the colour are an eyesore, and Mr. Graham is trying to ride roughshod over planning law, bristled a member of the Council for the Protection of Rural England. The supporters, however, outnumbered the opponents, and the term Graham's folly, originally brandished as a term of abuse, swiftly became a rallying point. The British, after all, love follies. And in the Cotswolds, the land of Broadway Tower, Sedgecote House, and Lord Berners' flights of architectural fantasy at Farringdon, it was an insult that backfired. As Lizzie puts it, a folly is a perfectly Cotswoldian thing to do. Other supporters spoke out in public. The Banksfield barn frontage is different, yes, but it is not hideous, wrote a Miss Turner of Blockley to the Cotswold Star. Mr. Martin's barn is a delight. I was fortunate enough to visit the opera in its somewhat bizarre surroundings, wrote DJ Baggett of Lower Swell. A new folly must in itself be a rarity and should not be dismissed out of hand. Perhaps, with some negotiation and planning consideration, Graham's folly could be reconsidered and allowed to remain. If it were, I'm sure that in years to come, it could give a great deal of pleasure to the many thousands who would see it. The council received 82 letters in support of the facade, with only 8 in opposition. Martin, meanwhile, did not hesitate to take the dispute onto a national stage. The broadsheets in particular embraced the story of an unequal struggle between killjoy officialdom and an irrepressible underdog, now calling himself a farmer, who dreamed of staging Carmen among the chickens.
This seems a very good time for some Wagner. We've talked a lot about Wagner. It's time to hear some. And what better than Loge's monologue from Das Rheingold, Immer ist und dankt, thankless was ever Loge's toil.
Ist undank Loges Lohn, für dich nur besorgt, sah ich mich um, durchstöbert im Sturm alle Winkel der Welt. Ersatz für Freier zu suchen, wie den Riesen wohl recht. Umsonst sucht ich und sehe nun wohl in der Welten Ring, nichts ist so reich als Ersatz zu Muten dem Mone für Weibes Wonne und weit leben und weben in Wasser, Erd und Luft. Viel frug ich, forschte bei allen, wo Kraft nur sie grillt und Keime sie kriegen, was wohl dem Mann am mächtigen Ding als Weibes Wonne und Weh. zwar weit leben, leben. Verlacht nur, was meine Fragen denn ist. In Wasser, Erd und Luft lassen wir nichts von Leben. Der sagte der Liebe ab, um rotes Gold entriete des Weibes Gunst. Des reines klare Kinder klagten mir ihre Not. Der Nebel und Nacht allmählich vergebens um der ballenden Gut. Als reine Gold, da raubte sich rächend der Dieb. Das stimmt ihm nun das teuerste Gut. Der Tiefe entwand, erklang mir der Töchter Klage an dich, Wotan, wenn sie dich doch zu Recht zögest den Räuber, das Gold dem Wasser wiedergibt. Gelobt ich den Mädchen. Nun löst der Loge sein Wort.
Brock, Anthony Negus, and we'll be hearing a little bit more Wagner in a short moment. But first, we've talked about buildings, we've talked a little bit about rep, but what about Longborough as a company, as an organisation? And I'm going to ask Polly, as you're sort of taking on this mantle a bit, how has it evolved, and can you give us a hint, really, of where it might be going?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously building towards our third full-scale ring cycle, which is happening in the summer, and I'm sure lots of you will be there. And then beyond that, we're really quite excited to be looking at repertoire that we've not done before. When I joined the organisation, I kind of got a real bee in my bonnet, and I was like, we have to start expanding the titles that we're programming, because there was quite a lot of, like, The Marriage of Figaro again. And I was quite keen to really flex our muscles and to take that kind of spirit of adventure, which of course Dad has established, but also, you know, Wagner was a highly adventurous artist, and I think it's really nice to take those exciting parts of what he stood for as an artist and run with them. So he was a revolutionary and he was an adventurer. So really, we're looking at titles, bringing in titles we've never done before. So since I've joined, that's happened, and we're continuing with that. Looking at some Strauss, some Wagner titles, which we have not yet performed. This is not, you know, this will be announced over the next couple of months. But I feel like maybe Richard should speak a bit more. We haven't had so much from Richard, and it is his book.
So Richard, yeah, do you want to kind of bring in, so the book is a story so far, I mean, could you want to actually give us a hint of some particular highlights, really, might be a sort of way to go from that then?
Of the present or the future, yeah. Or the past, or I don't know. I mean, I think Polly was talking say about broadening the repertoire, I think everyone agrees that Wagner has been very central, hasn't it, to the identity and the sort of the growth. And I mean, one thing I wanted to say about it's impressed me both about Martin and Lizzie and this family generally, is this idea that I mentioned in the book, when George Christie, it's often, Longborough is often compared to Glyndebourne, that spirit, that sort of friendliness, that sort of sense of a small group of people who come together to do something remarkable. And the way Glyndebourne perhaps was in the 1930s when it first started. Now, I hadn't realised until I started researching this book that when George Christie started Glyndebourne in the 30s, he had a dream of doing Wagner. He was going to do Parsifal in his second season and then move on to a Ring cycle. And he made the great mistake in his first season of surrounding himself with phenomenally experienced German musicians who promptly told him that couldn't be done. Be sensible. Now, Martin didn't have that disadvantage at the beginning. He came from the world of property development with no musical experience, so he didn't realise that he couldn't do the Ring cycle, and whereupon he went and did it. And I rather like that aspect of things, that you assume no door is closed until you're at least given it a hefty kick. And that's what I'm looking forward to seeing next. I mean, I was absolutely thrilled, and we've seen what's been achieved here. We've seen the Ring cycles. We know what's possible in this most unlikely of organisations. But when Korngold Die Tote Stadt was announced a few years ago, I knew Martin had been talking at it for years. It's an opera I've loved for years. Korngold's a kind of cult composer in some way, sometimes described that way, actually a hugely important figure between the wars. And he writes this music that once you actually hear it, once you see it staged, you realise it's fantastic. It's Puccini plus Richard Strauss plus Wagner on steroids in Technicolor. But telling people this is, and getting them to actually come and try it is a hard thing, because if they haven't heard it, they don't trust you. They assume you're going to feed them something awful. And we'll say, no, it's actually fabulous. And here we are. There's enough of a support at Longborough, a family of supporters, of regular concert goers, and a trust that has grown up between the performers, the artists, and the audience. So it means that you could take that risk, and everyone came, and I think you'll all agree it was absolutely knockout. I mean, it's a phenomenally difficult score. I never heard the orchestra play so well. Phenomenal achievement. And then, again, this sort of family thing, Rachel Nichols, who came in at the last moment to sing this role, which has, I think, only once been staged professionally in the UK, of Marie Marietta. And that was because, you know, the odds of pulling someone out the hat, singer at short notice who could sing and learn that role, almost impossible, but because of that relationship, those years, the care that Longborough had spent on her career earlier on, that sort of sense of friendship, of family, of teamwork, you know, she was willing to step up and just do that and do it phenomenally at short notice. And it just shows what can be achieved with this level, this kind of this model of people working together, of people being willing to try the impossible.
Highly perceptive direction as well.
Absolutely.
By Carmen Jacobi.
Absolutely.
I would like to take issue with the orchestra had never played so well. because I think over the years we have built up quite a reputation with our Wagner.
This criticism is a very, very high level.
But I know what you mean, because they'd never played a score of that nature before.
It's a phenomenally
and there's
score,
no doubt that they tackled it. Yeah. I mean, it was somewhat reduced. I think I ought to take the opportunity here just to mention the orchestra pit, because we did the small ring in the small pit, which probably could have housed 30 players or so. We had 24 for the small ring. But then when we had 2 years off, and 2005 and 6, in which I went to Pittsburgh to do the same version of the ring with Jonathan Eaton directing, Carmen and I both were there. She was helping with the direction. And then back in 2007, there we were, and Martin had got the diggers in, and the pit was now big enough to hold an orchestra. Well, we had 62 for Rheingold the first time, but we got up to 70 players in that space by the time we reached Götterdämmerung. So I think that's worth it.
I think just also picking up on Richard's point, I mean, it's absolutely credit to Anthony and Alan who talent spotted Rachel and many other artists and have...
She did Helmwiger the first year. She did Helmwiger. She came with a cold to audition in Covent Garden, a little room, and she said, would you like to hear my Woodbird as well? Because she said, I have a woodbird voice as well. If you remember, Rachel Nichols was doing a lot of Bach at that time. I don't say that Bach and the woodbird are quite the same, but she was doing cantatas and so on all over the place. So anyway, no, we said, we don't need to hear your woodbird voice. But anyway, that was the beginning.
And you know, asking about kind of where we're going, we're always increasing our kind of talent development program and very proud of, about that work and champion that work going forward as well. And another lovely thing that's happened is that we've now, Anthony has someone he's mentoring, Harry Sever, who also was the music director for Fairy Queen, rolling around on stage with his accordion and goodness knows what else. So really what we're trying to do, I think, I've got a bit of a tagline, which is culture, not cult. kind of taking all this wonderful energy and creativity and boldness and audacity and evolving it into a wider culture, a wider repertoire. Taking the fact that people have come to Longborough and kind of had Damascene conversions, they realised they could like Wagner. So what else could they like and discover? And let's go from there. That's the spirit of where we're at now.
I was thrilled when I had the opportunity to do the Magic Flute at Longborough, as well as Tristan in the same year, and then the following year to do Ariadne of Naxos. So, I mean, I do love conducting Wagner, and I'm really grateful. We've now done The Ring, we've done Tristan and Isolde twice, we did Tannhäuser, which was a breakthrough in terms of also Alan Privet's production, bringing in the chorus, really quite a large chorus for the first time. Because that's the thing, approaching Wagner works like Tannhäuser and Lohengrin and Meistersinger, could we ever do them at Longborough? That was the question because of the chorus. And I think this helped to prove that we could probably do that. So I'm very excited about Polly's ideas for the future, and I'm very much hoping I get the opportunity to conduct some very exciting pieces outside the Wagner. Big hit.
A great point. Well, I think on that then, you know, struck by ideas of sort of rebirth, evolution, shifting seasons, courage in adversity, which I think is a potentially tentative but nice segue perhaps into our final musical excerpt. So we've got Mark, we welcome Mark and Anthony again for our final. This is a case of we've got the Winterstürmer from Act One of Die Walküre.
Seiner Schwester schwor
Thank you. Thank you so much for your attention. Thanks to Mark, Roddy, Anthony for a fabulous selection of words and music, and to Sophie and Richard, of course, as well. If you want to hear more about our work, all my colleagues are here. Please do come and talk to them. Also, I'm delighted to say our wonderful new chairman, Andrew Mosley, is here. Please do say hello to him. Andrew, where are you? Give us a wave. Woo! Talk to them over coffee as you get your book signed. We're very grateful to all of our audience members for their ongoing support, their engagement, their curiosity. Thank you for your championship. We can't do it without you. We'd love to tell you there's going to be another book in 10 years' time with all the fantastic things we've done in the next 10 years. So keep it up. Thank you. See you in the summer, if not before.